Genesis 41. Genesis chapter 41, the story of Pharaoh's dreams. This is the chapter where it all starts to happen for Joseph. He started off as a slave. He becomes a ruler. I think that sounds very rare, almost unbelievable, but actually throughout history it happened an awful lot. There was a Diocletian became a ruler of the Roman Empire back in the 3rd century AD. There was a man in China called Zhu Yuanzhang, check my pronunciation please, who started off as a beggar but became emperor of China and founded the Ming Dynasty. Joseph starts off as a slave but becomes a ruler. He'd been sold into slavery at the age of 17. And now at the age of 30, it's taken 13 years, but he's made it. But he's not made it because he's an ambitious young man, a cocky young upstart. He becomes a ruler because God is with him. His success is because God gives him success. He's had a taste of that success in Potiphar's house, but now it's so much bigger, it all just explodes for him in a moment on the national stage. It shouldn't surprise us that this happens in Joseph's life, because humbling followed by exalting is the way God works. It's his modus operandi. This is how God does what he does in people's lives. So I want to look at how God does that in Joseph's life, firstly. And then, because Joseph, and I'll explain more about this, is a picture of Jesus Christ, I want to follow and trace that through in Jesus' life as well, how Joseph shows us how Jesus is to be humbled then exalted. And then thirdly, I want to think about how God does that in our lives as well. So the first point then is, God humbles Joseph, then exalts him. And we've said in previous weeks that God has been preparing Joseph. He's used some very humbling experiences for him. He's known what it's like to be thrown into a well by his brothers, sold into slavery. He goes into a foreign land and he just has to do whatever he's told by his Egyptian slave master. He's been falsely accused by Potiphar's wife, thrown into prison without a fair trial, stripped of all the freedoms and rights and privileges he'd gained under Potiphar. How humiliating. Now he's there in prison, in chains, around his neck. He's also had on-the-job training. He's had a form of an apprenticeship in Potiphar's house, and that's going to prove very useful. He's learned not only abilities of how to follow God and learn from him. He's learned how to be faithful in temptation. He's learned how God speaks through dreams. But he's also had practical training. He's learned how to run an Egyptian household, how to speak to an Egyptian superior, a leader, an important person. He's learned all about the agriculture of that household, all the farming, how the finances, the admin, skills that will be very useful serving Pharaoh. God doesn't prepare his people in overnight, through overnight transfiguration. Our whole lives equip us for the battles we will face. Joseph has a long period of training. Our whole lives, in a sense, are training for what will lie ahead. But now, the moment has arrived for Joseph. His star is going to rise. So, for the first few minutes, now, it's a long chapter, but we'll just go through it, really just paragraph by paragraph, summarising what happens to Joseph, how Joseph is exalted, lifted up, honoured in this chapter. In the first 8 verses, it describes Pharaoh's dreams. This is the third set of two dreams. Dreams come in twos in this section of Genesis. We've had Joseph's two dreams, then we've had the dream of the butler and the baker, and now Pharaoh has two dreams. In the first dream, he sees the seven thin cows eat up seven fat cows. Then he sees seven thin heads of grain eat up seven fat heads of grain. But when Pharaoh is troubled about this and he wants to know, in verse 8, what do my dreams mean? And he summons the experts. None of them can explain what these dreams actually mean. So verses 9 to 13, you've got the butler who suddenly clicks his fingers and remembers, I know who can help you here. Now he remembers Joseph. He remembers Joseph. In verses 14 to 16, Pharaoh summons Joseph. He has to shave, he has to put on some smart clothes, but off he goes. And in verses 17 to 24, he tells Joseph the dreams. Verses 25 to 32, Joseph then is able to interpret the dreams and tell him what they mean. Joseph's the only one who can do this. He says, look, there's going to be 7 years of plenty, the fat cows. And then that's going to be followed by 7 years of famine, where there's no food at all. Cows commonly were used to symbolise the nation of Egypt, and in particular its fertility, the crops that it was producing, how good the harvest was going to be. And then he says that the second dream is exactly the same. Same meaning. But the reason, he says in verse 32, the thing is established by God. That's why Pharaoh had two dreams, for the same reason. To make the point, God is going to make this happen. Pharaoh, it's going to happen. Joseph's been prepared for many years, over many years, for the moment when he will stand in front of the king of Egypt. There's an old episode of Mr. Bean, you might have seen this one, where he's getting ready to meet the queen. He's standing in a line, and he's just sort of typical Mr. Bean, constantly looking around, checking what everyone else is doing. Notices they've all got a little napkin in their pocket, so he tries to get one as well. Practicing his handshake. He's going to shake hands, and then he's going to bow. And of course, when it comes to it, he goes too far, and he grabs her by her hand, headbutts her, instead of just does a little bow, and she's on the floor, and off he goes. He's done his thing. I know we probably wouldn't do that, but we would be nervous like him. We would be preparing, getting ready, trying to do everything we can to get ready for that moment. God has been preparing Joseph for that moment. We wouldn't know what to say in that situation. If you had to stand in front of an Egyptian king, you wouldn't know the first thing to say. But Joseph knows that, because he's had all that experience with Potiphar. So when he comes to speak, he's full of wisdom and insight. And it's just obvious to Pharaoh, there is no one else like this man. Joseph actually goes beyond what he's been asked to do as well. I'm not sure I'd have the nerve to do that with the king. All the king's asked him to do is explain what the dream means. But Joseph goes beyond that, and in verses 33 to 36, he says, here's what you need to do about it, Pharaoh. This is the solution. Here is the action plan for you. Set someone wise over Egypt. Collect the grain over the next 7 years. Prepare for the famine. So it's one thing to be able to see that a disaster's coming. It's something else entirely to actually do something about it. In Second World War, 1941, Churchill warned Stalin, the Germans are going to invade. And Stalin had the warning, but he didn't do anything about it. Well, here's Joseph saying, it's not just a warning, here's the action plan, here's what we need to do. This as well, just in passing, God's saying this is definitely going to happen. God is sovereign. This is going to come to pass. But that doesn't lead to Joseph being inactive, to saying, oh, well, God's made a plan, he'll do what he'll do, no point in us doing it. No, actually, that's what drives him to his action, to his planning. He's so sure that God is sovereign that that's why he starts to act. If you look on then into verse 38, Joseph comes across as so wise and so capable, and that's because he has been uniquely prepared for this moment. Pharaoh hasn't come across anyone like this before because of all his experiences and his dealings with God. So in verse 40 onwards, he appoints him to be second in command. He gives him these fine robes to wear. Says, verse 43, he will ride in the second chariot. You can read about this sort of thing in Egyptian literature from the time, how the second in command, how people would all bow down to him as he rides around in his chariot. So verse 46 to 49, Joseph puts his plan into action. He gathers up in those 7 years as much grain as possible. As much grain, verse 49, as the sand of the sea. So much that it can't be counted. That's an interesting phrase to use, because it's a phrase that's come up once before in Genesis, and that's deliberate. It comes up back in Genesis 22, verse 17. And there, God is speaking to Abraham. He's telling Abraham he's going to have as many descendants as there is sand on the seashore. So we're meant to think back to that promise to Abraham. And then God goes on to say to Abraham, Genesis 22, verse 18 now, in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Well, that's going to happen with Joseph. By the end of the chapter, all the nations of the earth will be blessed through Joseph. He will be a blessing, providing food to everyone in the world. Moses is showing us that the promises to Abraham are being fulfilled, partly at least, in Joseph. Well, on a personal level for Joseph as well, God is comforting him. Verses 50 to 52, he gives him children, and the names he chooses are worth noticing. He chooses Manasseh. He says, because God has made me forget all my toil, all my struggles. God's healing those wounds for Joseph from the past. And then there's Ephraim, still in Egypt, the land of my affliction. But God's made him fruitful there, he says. Well, then verse 53 to 57, you reach the climax of this whole chapter. The famine comes, as God said it would. Everyone goes to Joseph. He's the one who has bread. He's the one who feeds the whole world. God gives Joseph great success. That doesn't mean we should conclude that he is going to give us the same sort of success as Joseph. It doesn't mean he will give us a position in government. He will give us chariots with people riding around. But I don't know if you could explain why not. It's worth thinking about that just for a moment. Joseph is living in Old Testament times, under the old covenant, in an era where God makes a covenant, an agreement, with a nation, the nation of Israel. And as they obey, they receive physical blessings, physical territory, land, physical children. All those things are signs that God is blessing them. We thought this morning about rain and harvest. Those physical things were tied up with it as well. So God is blessing Joseph here, physically, materially, as he is then a blessing to all of the nations. We're New Testament believers here this evening. And there's a new covenant where God's law is written on our hearts, it says. A new nation of God, a new people of God, not a physical nation, but the church now. You see how there's this been a shift from physical to spiritual blessings in the new covenant we're in. So it doesn't mean you'll have the sort of wealth and success that Joseph has, but actually what we get is even more wonderful we can be confident of great spiritual blessings, parallel to the physical ones that Joseph gets. Well, secondly tonight, God humbles Jesus and then exalts him. And I think, well, okay, why are we talking about Jesus at this point? And the reason is, the Lord Jesus said on the road to Emmaus, all the scriptures speak about him. In every chapter of the Bible, Jesus is being spoken about. So how does this chapter do it? And the answer is that Joseph's life and the ebbs and flows, the successes and the downsides, are a picture of the life that Jesus Christ will live. Joseph is a shadow of Christ. With a shadow, I think I've said this before, a shadow, you can see the outline, but not the detail. Joseph's life gives us an outline of the life of Jesus. That's why we read Philippians 2 earlier. It shows us how Christ was humbled and then exalted. When you think about it, you can see those parallels right through Joseph's life. Let's think about how Joseph was humbled as he was misunderstood and hated by his brothers. So was Jesus. His brothers didn't understand who he was and why he'd come. Joseph was betrayed, sold into the hands of others by those who should have been closest to him. So was Jesus. Joseph went through great temptation, day after day, with Potiphar's wife. But he resisted. So did Jesus Christ. Joseph was falsely accused of crimes he didn't commit. He didn't get the right to a fair trial. So did Jesus. Same for him. Joseph was sent to prison. And as he's there in prison, there are two people there, a butler and a baker. And one of them will be rescued. And one of them won't be. Jesus goes to the cross. And there are two people there with him. One will be rescued and one won't be. You see the parallels, the rises and falls of Joseph. It shows us what Christ's like. It shows us the shape of Jesus Christ. It's not a perfect shape. Joseph's still a sinful person, but it's a shape nonetheless. That's why when Jesus comes, it shouldn't surprise us that he comes humbly. As a child who will have his nappies changed and who will be weaned and who will learn to talk from the very people he actually created. Jesus' life was characterized by being humbled, learning to serve others, growing in wisdom and stature. Why did God do that in the life of Jesus? Why did God do things that way? Well, I'll give you a couple of reasons I think will help us. Firstly, Joseph's example helps us. Jesus is a real man, just like Joseph. When Joseph was 17, would he have been ready to stand before Pharaoh? No, he wouldn't have been ready. He would have been like most 17-year-old boys put in that position. He wouldn't have had a clue what to do. And even if Pharaoh had then appointed him second in command, he wouldn't have known where to start putting that plan into action, carrying it out. Joseph needed that time to develop. And it's important we remember Jesus is a real man who grows up, who starts his public ministry when he's 30. We're told Jesus grew in wisdom and stature. He had growing to do as a human. But secondly, God does this because God's glory shines most brightly when he exalts those whom he has humbled. God's glory shines most brightly when he exalts those who have been humbled. We're seeing that in Joseph's life. That Joseph did not reach that position by himself. God did it. And so God gets all the glory. God gives him success. And God's glory shines so much more brightly as Jesus goes to the cross and conquers death. I guess it's a little bit like magicians. Have you ever seen a really bad magician at work? It's pretty difficult to sit there and watch a magician where you think, this is terrible, you're so clumsy, you're making this, I know exactly how you're doing this. But when you see someone do something incredible, and it just takes your breath away, you think, wow, he's a talented magician. How did he do that? That's the same sort of thing we've got here with Jesus. Acting, we're sort of escaping from what seemed to be an impossible situation. That's what we have happens here with Joseph and Jesus. Joseph is exalted. Jesus is exalted too. Let's think about those similarities too for a moment. Joseph is raised here in this chapter to a position of power and authority. He rules over others. Even people like Potiphar's wife, she is now lower down the food chain. Potiphar himself is as well. Jesus too is raised to a position of power and authority, and all authority is his. Both of them show tremendous wisdom in how they rule. Joseph doesn't abuse his position. He gets on with the work. Tremendous wisdom to prepare people for the future, for this famine. Lord Jesus, there's never been a wiser ruler than Jesus Christ. He wants his enemies to be forgiven, to come under his wing. With both Jesus and Joseph having been rescued themselves, they then go to rescue others. Joseph rescues the whole nation, in fact the whole world, from starvation. Jesus rescues us from spiritual death. And then both, in fact, bring blessing to the whole world. All nations come to Joseph for physical food. That's a picture of Jesus Christ. How everyone in the world comes to him and has our deepest needs met. We come to him and he feeds us. He satisfies our souls. Humbling before exalting is God's pattern for Joseph. And it's God's pattern for Jesus. That's why we read Philippians chapter 2, where Paul is tracing that pattern. So thirdly, you probably won't be surprised what the third point is, God humbles his children, then exalts them. In other words, that pattern applies to us as well. One of the reasons Joseph's story is recorded in this way in the Bible is because it teaches us how God deals with his children. How he prepares us for the future. He puts Joseph through these humbling, difficult experiences, and he puts his own son through them too. So that means it shouldn't surprise us when he does the same thing in our lives too. But the thing is, it does still surprise us when that happens. In fact, it's anticipated that it'll surprise us. The Bible anticipates that. 1 Peter 4, verse 12, Peter says this, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings." You notice what Peter says there. Don't think it strange when that fiery trial comes. And the reason he's saying that is because that is what we naturally think when those trial comes. It pops up and we think, what's going on there? Why is that happening? I wasn't expecting that. I didn't think that was the plan. I thought being a Christian meant that wouldn't happen in my life. Peter says, don't be surprised. Nothing strange is happening here. Don't be surprised about this new period of pain. Don't be surprised when you thought it was going to end, but it just takes you on more and more twists and turns on this journey. You keep thinking it's going to end, but it doesn't. The suffering of Jesus was varied, and it was sustained and prolonged, and there were times when it must have felt like he was being attacked by all sides. Satan trying to take him by surprise. As followers of Christ, that is the path we're on as well. Don't think it's strange. There's nothing unusual going on here when we're in the midst of a crisis. It doesn't mean God's forgotten about us. It doesn't mean that that wound which keeps on reopening in new and painful ways, that doesn't mean God's punishing us. Peter says it's the opposite. It means that we're sharing in Christ's suffering. It means we're following his path. Don't think it's strange. Don't be surprised by it. And when you see the long perspective of this, this is God's pattern. That's what he did with Joseph. That's what he did with Jesus. That's how God works. And he does it so that his glory will shine even more brightly in our lives. Our trials also point us as well to what the future is. Joseph was exalted. He became a ruler. He was humbled, yes, but he was lifted up and honoured and had people bowing down to him. Jesus was exalted too. He triumphed over the grave. He made a spectacle of his enemies publicly. He's been exalted. He rules today. Your suffering is actually your guarantee that you will be exalted. There is going to come a day when God's people rule the whole of this world with Christ. Every enemy gone and banished, sin defeated, because Christ's victory over sin is our victory over sin. All of that happens because of one great theological truth. I'll close by saying this. One great truth that we touched on once or twice in the last couple of weeks. Union with Christ. Children, we are joined with Christ. We are joined to him. That means we follow that same pattern, that same path. It means we suffer because he suffers. His suffering is ours. But it also means his victory is our victory. That happens because we're joined to Jesus Christ. We can't be separated from him. And it's as we take hold of that great truth that we're joined to him, that we won't find those trials quite so strange and surprising, and we'll start to see God's hand in them. And they'll even give us confidence. This is God showing his love for me. This is God's pattern. Humbling, then exalting. It's the pattern for Joseph. It's the pattern for Jesus. And it's the pattern for us. Don't be surprised. Don't think it's strange, Peter says. It's for our good. And it's for God's glory. Let's close by singing. Number 469, if you're using a hymn book. 469, I cannot tell why he whom angels worship. There's lots of things we don't know, we can't understand. But this hymn reminds us of the truths that we do know and hold on to. 469.